Chris, I've read all of your novels and loved them all, and I can't tell whether you changed as a writer or I've changed as a reader, because your newest book, Anima Rising, was as funny as I expected it to be, but it was also felt weirdly moving in a way I did not expect. Am I just reading it differently, or did you write a weirdly moving book?
Oh, it's male menopause. It's the same thing that makes you burst into tears watching dog food commercials. So in short, it's both of us.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. I'm Austin Titchener, co-artistic director of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, now in its 19th year, number 961, Christopher Moore's Frankenstein. It's May, and not only is my adaptation of Christopher Moore's novel Fool opening later this month, Chris is heading out on a book tour next week to promote his new novel Anima Rising, the funny and, as I said, weirdly moving story of the famous painter Gustav Klimt fishing a woman out of the Danube in 1911 Vienna. It's a story of art, friendship, and survival on a surprisingly epic scale. And it's always great to talk to Chris about how he does what he does.
We're just sentimental weaklings at this point in our development.
Just a couple of old saps.
I do not know. If you could expound on what it was that specifically touched you appropriately.
Consensually.
I can comment on whether that was on purpose or an accident.
Well, one of the things, I mean, Anima Rising is filled with your signature moves. In many ways, it felt like a culmination of all your work. It's got detectives. It's got a supernatural creature. It's got the painters in the artistic world, creators, artists. It's got a bawdy sisterhood. It had so many elements, and I guess it was your leading character of Judith.
Mm-hmm.
What she survives and how she's able to come out the other side, mm-hmm, felt very moving to me and heroic. It's a long journey for Judith, and it was very, very satisfying.
That was on purpose. And I think that initially when I conceived of the book, it was going to be a book about Gustav Klimt and Egon Schiele, the Viennese artists that are in the book. It's not a spoiler to say the book opens with Gustav Klimt finding this woman floating in the Danube Canal, which is where they pull ships out of the Danube River to unload them. So I didn't make a mistake. It's just it's like the driveway of the Danube. and she becomes the main character of the book. When I conceived of the book, it was going to be about Klimt. And because I love his paintings, but as I learned more, I thought it can't be about Klimt. It has to be the journey of this character who in the novel Frankenstein does not survive. But the premise of the book is that in Anima Rising, the mate that Dr. Frankenstein is forced to make for the Frankenstein monster, or Adam as I call him, she survives. Yeah. And that's the character Judith, and that's who Klimt finds in the Danube Canal. And it became she's very childlike when he first finds her, because she's recently been dead and she sort of loses her memory, and that becomes a plot driver for it. But the journey of she and these other models that work for Klimt and the society around them, what we were looking at were young working class girls, or lower class girls who had no options.
Right.
You know, and so it was an accomplishment to get a job as a model for Gustav Klimt, because he paid really well. He paid 8 crowns an hour, which was the best you could make if you were a young woman, particularly in the case of Wally Neutzel, who is based on a real character. You know, she's only 16 when she starts to work for Clint. And the drawback, I guess, is that you have to sleep with Clint. And it was every book I read on him said that it was understood that if you worked for the master, that you would share his bed. And he typically had, you know, a half a dozen models in his studio at any given time in different states of undress. So what transpires in the studio beyond painting and drawing, I just extrapolate from those things. And it's a very austere. Is that the right word? Ethically austere environment for these young women.
Yeah.
And so this becomes the story of how they escape it, I guess. And Judith is the, you know, the least powerful character in the beginning and becomes the most powerful character by the end of the book. And so I guess that's it. And along the way, she meets characters who, some real and some not, who, reinforce this journey that she has. And she's buoyed by Inuit god, which we'll get I'm sure we'll get to at some point.
Right. Another element Inuit spiritual gods, trickster figures from various mythologies also comes in to the story.
Yeah, and what's more natural than to have Inuit gods in Vienna in 1911? You know, it's like coffee and cream.
Well, it's like, it's timeless. I mean, these figures are timeless, and I guess that's what makes the story so modern, is that you don't shy away from this ethical ambiguity of the world. But you also depict the women. I find this moving too. Maybe is the women are not. The women form a community of support for each other. They're not at each other like rivals or I don't know, like they do in snarky comedies or snarky soap operas.
They're not mean girls.
They're not mean girls. Yeah. Yes, they're supportive girls, and that's really, it's really fun. Great. All right, so you planned it this way. Now I know.
Yeah, but it wasn't how the project was originally conceived, but it's what it ended up doing. And I think it's a better story, but it was harder than I thought, and I don't want to whine about it, you know, because I've got the coolest job in the world, but it was like, what was I, there was many parts in this book, like, what was I thinking when I decided I would have Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung as characters?
Yeah. And yet I've heard you say over the years that you've been writing this and we've been having lunches in Northern California over the years, you said this is a harder book than maybe some of your previous ones. And yet the effort, it doesn't feel effortful on the page. It feels absolutely natural. So somehow you managed to polish up these rocks and put them in a lovely bowl where they look like they go together really well.
Hi, I'm Scott Simon of NPR News. You're listening to the Reduce Shakespeare Company podcast. Fool.
Where can you RSC the RSC? Our spring tour of all the great books abridged concludes next week with 3 performances at Nicolet College on May 16th and 17th in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. Check out the touring page at our website, ReducedShakespeare.com, or our social media pages for venue and ticket information. Now back to my conversation with Christopher Moore, talking about his new novel, Anima Rising, which comes out next week.
Am I right that it felt like not a literal but a spiritual sequel to Sacre Bleu?
Oh, I think for sure.
Yeah.
I think for sure, and I think part of that was my personal part of Sacre Bleu was the research was such a joy.
Yeah.
You know, from visiting American art museums, including your beloved Art Institute of Chicago. Where I maintain, I keep my collection for everybody else to see, and I will just visit.
We thank you.
Yeah, I like to go and visit Sunday in the Park or Sunday in the Banks of Le Grand Jatte or whatever by Seurat, just to make sure it's fine and they're taking care of it. But that, and then living in Paris for 3 months, and the travel that led into that, and all the academic, it was just a joy. It was such a joy. And I thought, I want to replicate that experience, but I don't want to replicate that experience.
Right.
And so the next kind of renaissance in art is in Vienna. And it's, Vienna in this period from about 1905 to about 1913 was, what they call a genius cluster, where you had these world-renowned scientists, these world-renowned artists, these world-renowned composers, these world-renowned, all these great figures of history all interacting at one time in one place. So that's where I set it. And that's what it has in common with Sacre Bleu, which is set in Paris in 1890, which is the same situation. There's right. just everybody is there. In Sacre Bleu, I could have, I had Oscar Wilde was there. I could have had Mark Twain. And this is literally just in the 1891 part,
right.
You know, as well as Toulouse-Lautrec and Van Gogh and Monet and Renoir and Degas and, you know, Emil Zola and I mean, just unbelievable list of luminaries in that city at that time. And Vienna was this way. So it definitely is a spiritual sibling of Sacre Bleu.
And when did you decide to combine this spiritual sequel to Sacre Bleu with The Bride of Frankenstein? And also, were you consciously trying to emulate Mary Shelley's writing style? Because Judith's reminiscences of her life experience when she's under hypnosis reads like Mary Shelley.
Well, I was making fun of the style. The Frankenstein is an epistolary novel.
Yeah.
And we get the beginning of it. It begins and ends in the Arctic.
Yeah.
Which explains a lot of the weird logistics of the novel. But it's letters from a sea captain, a romantic era sea captain, 1899 or 1799. To his sister about this strange man he's found on the ice. Yeah. So I sort of affected the style of those letters, but with the complete lack of self-awareness that the character has, whereas he's talking about talking to his sister is like, you'll never know the responsibility of having an estate because you're a woman and having to carry the family name because you're a woman. And he makes all these snide remarks to his sister, thinking he's just being considerate of her. You know, he's being empathetic by thinking, well, she's you being a woman, you don't understand anything or know anything, and therefore, right. And so that's where you get that sort of high-minded style. And then Judith affects that because she is a product of that time,
sure.
when she's being regressed, and it's like the Shakespeare books, it's not romantic and by that I mean time period. It's romantic-y. It's just like my dialect in the Shakespeare books is not Shakespeare,
right.
or Jacobean or Elizabethan. It's Shakespeare-y. So it kind of sounds Shakespeare-y, but it's, you know, there's a thee and thou there occasionally to make it sound like to the American ear. Oh yeah, that sounds totally Shakespeare-y to me. And that's how Judith's voice is. And then because she is initially, we won't find out, and I won't spoil this, but she was a smartass before she became the lady monster.
Yes.
And that comes out.
Yes.
You know,
she retained some of her original character.
Exactly. That's what, yeah, she can't remember who she was, but we know that she was snarky.
Right.
And that sort of carries through. And so there's a certain modernism to that rhetoric that she carries with her too.
What gave you the idea to have Gustav Klimt discover the Bride of Frankenstein in the Danube?
I was looking for Northern Europe stories. I was going to take the story was going to take place in Northern Europe, and that was a Northern European kind of iconic story. I had written zombies, I'd written vampires. You know, the subtitle of Frankenstein is The Modern Prometheus.
Yeah.
And I wasn't interested in The Modern Prometheus. I wasn't interested in Dr. Frankenstein. I was interested in modern fire, what he created. And the character of Adam, of the Frankenstein monster, is such a whiner through the entire book.
He really is.
He's just like, I'm suffering, and I'm going to make you suffer because I'm suffering, and you have no idea how alienating it is. And
he's an intellectual whiner because of the books he's picked up along the way.
Exactly. And I had to dial that back. I was like, nobody's going to get these references, but he's very, very articulate. For a guy who learned how to speak by looking through the crack of a pigsty in on an old Lyme family.
And reading Goethe.
Yeah, he sounds a lot more like somebody that grew up with Shelley and Byron, you know?
Yeah, right.
So anyway, the juxtaposition, the contrast is, of course, he's talking about how much he's suffering to this woman he's made a sex slave of.
Right.
There's a certain irony that was built into that. And I was more interested in that. So I guess to answer your question is it initially was geography, but it was also a story. And now that all these other Frankenstein stories are coming out, I realized I did not have to have a 100-year gap in there for some historic integrity. I could have just made Frankenstein 100 years later, but no. I said it the first part of it in 1799 and the last part of it in 1911. And then I sort of come up with a conceit for how that time passes with this character. But that was dumb. It was just a dumb thing to do.
But of such dumb things is comedy made. You're about to head out on a book tour around the country. And we were talking just last week, Reed Martin and I were talking about the things that are funny to us that turn out to be funny to only us. How do you know what the things that you write as jokes, how do you know whether they're going to work with an audience when the book doesn't come out and people don't read it for years?
That's just guessing. I mean, for the actual text, you just have to hope.
Yeah.
You know, on book tour, I always apologize to my San Francisco audience because they're my first audience. And so I have this usually 3 or 4 pages of notes, and I walk away going, well, there's about a quarter of this that worked. And so the people in San Francisco are like, yeah, don't go see him. he's not that fun, you know, if you get your book signed. So that's just like anybody else. It's like you do, is you see how the audience responds. And I've learned from my comedian friends is that if you ad lib something and people laugh, write it down and use it again, you know. So by the time, and I only tour now, it'll only be like 2 weeks. It used to be, you know, 4 or 5, but by the end of the fifth week, I wasn't doing anything that I was doing on the first night.
Sure.
Because it had evolved through, and that's how material is written. But you know, and then there's a certain amount of the book that you have to adhere to because you're there to talk about the book. But the stuff that's usually not funny. That's like behind baseball kind of stuff. You know, yeah. It's like when I think early on when we first met and you said, well, it's nice to talk shop. And I told you, that's all I know how to talk. I don't know how to talk to anything else.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, except for one more thing, which I'll share with you in about 60 seconds. So stick around. Christopher Moore's new novel, Anima Rising, comes out on May 13th, 2025, and he'll be appearing in bookstores around the country to promote it and sign your copy. Go to his website, chrismoore.com, for more information. Then send us your obscene creations via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com, or throw a comment to us over on the socials or on our own actual website, reducedshakespeare.com, or visit my website, theshakespeareans.com. Thanks as always to Prometheus's First Draft, Matthew Croak, web services by Ginger Power Limited, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout out this week goes to Terry Roberts. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Scott Simon from National Public Radio. And as always, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 961 2883rds of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. Now it's occurring to me that it's not high concept, but it feels like there's a comic novel to be written about a novelist on a book tour.
Usually those types of books are about somebody who works in academia. Everybody's written those books. Nabokov wrote those books. Sure. Richard Russo has written those books. Sidaris, you know.
Right, right. I can't help but be intrigued by the notion of you on a book tour encountering in real life a Christopher Morian supernatural trickster creature, and what happens next.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reduceshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.